Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, building peace within divided communities. Caritas Internationalis launches a new online toolbox for effective conflict resolution. And 29 years on from the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero, we present a dramatization of his life and death, looking at the legacy he left to the Church of El Salvador today. Caritas Internationalis, the global Catholic confederation of aid and development agencies, has launched a new internet initiative to help build peace among divided communities and nations, bringing together one of the oldest problems in history, peace building, with some of the newest internet technologies. The organization this week unveiled its first online toolkit to provide community leaders with an extensive range of materials and practical ideas that they can use in a wide variety of conflict situations. The new website, which you can find at www.caritas.org, draws on the rich tradition of Catholic social teaching, but can also be used by people of all different faiths or none, and is designed to be user-friendly and adaptable to local communities and their problems. Caritas spokesman Patrick Nicholson told my colleague Linda Bordoni more about the ideas behind this new peace and reconciliation initiative.
What we did was comb all the institutions, all the NGOs, and all the academic material which provides peace builders with the training materials they need to build peace at a community level. And we put all those pages together, about 300, onto a website. And we created a navigation system, which we think is really easy to use and takes you just through one click to the material that you need. And so what it allows is trainers to build their own workshops very, very quickly and very, very easily through the web. And it's a really an unrivaled source anywhere in the world. It doesn't compare with any other peace building web toolkit. None exists, so this is the first one.
Now let's get down to the very basics. The trainers, this is whom the toolkit is actually aimed at. Who are the trainers?
Well, they're people that work in communities mostly. I mean, if communities are divided, for example, in Tanzania, you have Muslims and Christians living side by side, and occasionally, you know, there's tension. For example, 18 months ago, there was tension in one village in Tanzania where a Christian butcher was accused of selling pork to a Muslim family. And that could flare up quite quickly. And what the trainers can do is bring the communities together, run through these workshops with them, and so the different sides can understand where the other is coming from, and they can work through their problems and their tensions in a very constructive manner. But it's also, we also work at a kind of national level as well, bringing peace about nationally, so where there are different political parties or different religious groups or ethnic groups, is to bring those groups together and work through the differences through these really easy, simple tools.
South Africa is one country where this kind of peace and reconciliation work is already flourishing. Over recent months, Caritas has helped to train several hundred leaders or facilitators who bring local people together in small groups to discuss tensions or violent conflicts and find ways of resolving their disputes in a positive and constructive way. Many parts of the country, which Anglican Archbishop Desmond Tutu once famously described as a rainbow nation, are still plagued with daily violence, a lasting legacy of the decades of racist apartheid policies. Holy Cross sister Anya Hughes coordinates Caritas programs for Southern Africa and is enthusiastic about this new online peace-building kit. She told Linda Bordoni more about her own experience in this work and her hopes about how this initiative can help bring real reconciliation among South Africa's divided communities.
Yes, as you say, a peace is something that's really needed in South Africa, because South Africa has become, and it is a very, very violent country. the whole fabric of society is very, very violent. So using peace building as a mechanism for enabling people to come together, look at their own situation, and to see how they can transform their own situation. Using the Caritas Peace Building Manual has been an absolutely invaluable tool for us.
Sister Anya, can you tell us how it works?
In the manual, in the original manual, the whole manual is set out to end with different modules. And the module is set out with reflections, activities, time for group discussion, and then time for action as well. And then people engage in the whole process. It's a very, very participative process. And it enables people to look at themselves as individuals. It also enables people to look at how they engage in groups and then how they can translate that into the broader society. So it's a very, very hands-on, practical tool that enables people to use it when they go back into their communities and into the broader society. There are a number of different modules, and the primary module really is looking at nonviolence, how we can transform our, you know, the violent situations in which we find ourselves and act in a nonviolent way within those situations and create a whole nonviolent community.
Sister Anya, it's all very well to talk about peace building, but most people don't really know how you go about peace building. Who is involved? And, you know, how do you get through to the communities? Who are the trainers?
Yes. In fact, we have been very fortunate here in South Africa because we have formed a partnership with an organization called Damietta Peace Initiative, which is a Franciscan peace program. And what we do is we enable communities, first of all, to tell their own story, of violence, to share that story with the group. And it's about building the trust in the group, and it's about building the relationships within the group. Having done that, then we look at, you know, what are the root causes? Try and get people to reflect on why did this happen and why did this happen in this particular way? And go deeper and deeper into the root causes of the conflict or the violence. And then we go into looking at what are our different faith perspectives on this issue. And this is where, because it's a multi-faith, we engage with multi-faith communities. And so we get each person in the group to share, you know, from their faith perspective what their faith says about this particular issue. And it's quite amazing that, you know, all the mainline religions in particular, you know, have the same basic philosophy on violence. Then from that, we get them to look at what action they can do as a group to live out what that their particular faith perspective is giving them to live out. And it's quite amazing what happens in communities. They decide on small actions in communities, and they begin to address the issue in small ways within their communities. And this has an impact on the broader community. And then the broader community then starts asking the questions, why are you doing this and why are you doing this in this particular way? And then they start sharing again why they're doing it and why they have chosen a nonviolent way.
Is there any specific story you can tell us? Is there any particular instance that you remember during these years in which you have experienced peace building? I don't know, some person who had a special story who came back to you, something like that that can stay in our minds.
The one that comes to mind immediately is a 71-year-old Afrikaner lady. She shared, well, in the group, she came to the group initially because her friend wanted to come, and her friend didn't have transport, and so she came, she brought her friend, and she made it quite clear in the group, you know, I'm only here because my friend needed transport. And for the first 2 days of the workshop, she didn't participate at all, hardly. She sat in the groups, in the small groups, she listened to everything, and was, you know, was quite silent and quite withdrawn. And on the third day, we asked people to share, you know, what struck them in the in the weekend workshop. Everybody shared and she hadn't shared. And we were about to close. And she says, excuse me, I would like to say something. Yeah. Wow. And he said, I want to make a confession. All these years, I've grown up in South Africa, and all these years, I've hated black people. And when the foreigners started coming in, I just kept saying to myself, these people must go back to where they come from. They don't belong here. We have enough problems here. And see, that has been my attitude all my life. I've listened all this weekend. I have listened to what has... And she said, I have been so touched by what I have heard and seen in this group. I just want to say to you how sorry I am for the way I've lived my life. And she went around. There were people from 9 different nationalities, and I think about 7 or 8 different religions in that group. She went around to every single one of them and hugged them and asked them for forgiveness. And everybody was in tears when she had finished. It was just so powerful.
Thank you. That is powerful. One last thing. What about children, very young children? Surely they should be the ones whom we should address peace-building messages to. They're the future. Do your peace-building initiatives take children into consideration?
Yes, very much so, in fact. We have actually one of our trainers... works very, very well with children, and he has a special gift for children, in fact. And he has been working in the schools, in some of the schools in and around Pretoria in particular, and he has formed what we call groups in the school. We call them PACs, Pan-African Conciliation Teams, in the schools. And the young people themselves are actually now taking over the running of these groups in the schools. They are very, very excited to actually learn a new way. And in one of the schools, in fact, the teachers have also formed their own PACT group. And the parents are now asking also because they want to know what's happening with their children. And they're coming forward. And they're saying, now we would also like to have a group in our community. So some of the parents, but the children have impacted on their teachers and on the parents. We're also looking at preschools, and one of the dreams I have, and I was surfing the web and looking at the new toolkit yesterday, and I was looking at it and thinking, I would love to develop a manual for preschool children, because even in South Africa, even preschool children are extremely violent, because they have grown up in a violent context. I would love to develop a manual with bright colors and lots of activities for preschool children. That's one of the dreams that I have, and I hope I will find the time to develop that.
Sister Anya Hughes, coordinator for Caritas programs in South Africa, speaking with Linda Bordoni. The new online peace-building initiative was launched by Caritas this week to mark the anniversary of the assassination of Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero, gunned down as he was saying Mass on March 24, 1980. Let's listen now as Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett present a dramatization of his life, his violent death, and the lasting legacy he left to the Church and the people of El Salvador today.
It was the evening of the 24th of March, 1980. In the chapel of the Hospital of Divine Providence, Monsignor Oscar Romero, Archbishop of San Salvador, was celebrating Mass.
Oscar Arnulfo Romero was born on the 15th of August, 1917, in the small town of Ciudad Barrios, El Salvador, near the border with Honduras.
son of a telegraphist, he went to the village school and was apprenticed to a carpenter at the age of 13.
But the young Romero had other ideas, and the following year he left home to study for the priesthood. After his ordination in Rome in 1942, he returned to El Salvador, where he soon gained a reputation for his preaching and dedication to pastoral work.
The Vatican Council came and went. Father Romero read the documents, but was not particularly enthusiastic. In 1967, he celebrated his priestly Silver Jubilee and was given the courtesy title of Monsignor. A few months later, he was appointed Secretary General of the National Bishops' Conference. He left for the capital, San Salvador.
Romero seemed set for a brilliant church career. His next appointment was as Executive Secretary to the Central American Bishops' Secretariat. Then, in 1970, Archbishop Luis Chavez of San Salvador asked to have Romero as his auxiliary bishop. He was consecrated in June of the same year, in the presence of the president and army officials.
Romero took as his episcopal motto, Sentire con l'Iglesia, to be of one mind with the Church. But this in El Salvador meant being of one mind with the regime, and the new bishop, surrounded as he was by the pomp and circumstance of the established order, looked well to do just that. No one would have suspected that in less than a decade, this short, unimpressive figure with the thick glasses would make the name of Romero a blazing torch for justice and the rights of man.
Before that was to happen, Oscar Romero was to undergo a profound change of heart, brought about gradually by a series of events which drew him inevitably into the arena of political conflict and forced him to make a commitment, the option for the poor, which cost him his life.
Of the 5 million people who inhabit the smallest republic in the Americas, half live well below the breadline. Since the beginning of the century, the country has been in the hands of what is known as the oligarchy, 14 landowning families, mainly of European origin. The dispossessed Indian farmers were reduced to the status of agricultural labourers, living off black beans and maize pancakes. But when they staged a revolt in 1932, it was brutally suppressed and 30,000 were left dead. Since then, the nation has been run by the armed forces, opposition regularly repressed, and presidential elections as regularly rigged.
When the Council of Latin American Bishops met at Medellin in 1968, the majority agreed that the poor must undertake the struggle for a more just society. In El Salvador, while the Jesuits opted openly for the poor, the bishops remained immobile. Far from encouraging the initiative, they even opposed it, Romero included.
In 1974, Romero was appointed Bishop of Santiago de Maria, a diocese of some 30,000 people, which included his own birthplace. In June of the following year, the National Guard raided a hamlet in the diocese, shooting and hacking to death five campesinos in a house-to-house search for concealed weapons. Romero said Mass for the victims, and in his sermon condemned this attack on human rights, following it up with a private letter of protest to President Molina. It didn't seem necessary to protest publicly, as he explained to his fellow bishops. After all, the church was not rarely involved, nor was it just yet.
But as one land reform law after another came to nothing, the people of El Salvador began to grow restless. The campesinos formed unions, and the Archbishop of San Salvador, Monsignor Chavez, endorsed their right to do so. The ruling classes were furious, and as Chavez was near retirement and his views were not shared by the rest of the hierarchy, a successor was looked for.
The conservative Romero seemed the ideal candidate. Aged 55 and in poor health, he was hardly the man to step into the forefront of the political fray.
Before he had even been installed, the government began a nationwide media campaign of attack on the committed clergy. Then six priests were arrested, tortured, and deported to Guatemala. The retiring Archbishop Chavez asked Romero to take over quickly, which he did in an almost private ceremony.
A few days later, when a new president was announced after clearly fraudulent elections, 50,000 people staged a protest demonstration in the main square. Troops fired into the crowd, and to this day, no one knows how many died.
The priests of the archdiocese, together with the archbishop, met to discuss the situation. Romero listened to what each had to say. Then he spoke.
Let's stop talking. Go home, all of you, and take care of the people. Open your houses to any who think they may be in danger. Check to see if they really are being followed, and if they are, take them in and hide them.
The next event touched the Archbishop personally. A Jesuit priest and close friend of his, Father Rutilio Grande, was shot down together with two of his parishioners. Father Grande worked in Aguilares, a poor town on the road to the Honduras frontier. He had taught his people to value their own dignity and to measure everyday life against the standards of the gospel. For some time now, he'd been considered too outspoken.
The death of Rutilio Grande was Romero's moment of truth. If he had been uncertain before as to where his place was, he was certain now. It was with the people.
One of the first things he did after burying his friend was to set up a permanent committee to monitor human rights in the country. Then he went to Rome to inform the Pope of the option he'd made. Paul VI took Romero's hand in his own and told him to be of good heart.
Back in El Salvador, the spiral of violence continued. When the foreign minister was found murdered, another priest was killed in revenge. 200 priests concelebrated the funeral mass with the archbishop, whose sermon against violence was broadcast on the archdiocese's own network. It was to become a tradition, and soon Romero was commanding the largest audience in the country.
The Archbishop celebrated his 60th birthday by opening a coffee bar for his priests in the archdiocesan offices and by leaving the Episcopal Palace and going to live at a cancer hospital for the poor. The clergy and religious of the country, who were now firmly behind him, issued a statement. Whoever touches the Archbishop touches the heart of the Church.
The bishops were quite another matter. Only one, Bishop Arturo Rivera Damas, shared his views on social questions. In August 1978, the two men produced a pastoral letter in which they defended the right of all people to organize themselves for their own protection and to further their own just aims.
Monsignor Rivera Damas, who succeeded Romero as Archbishop of San Salvador, reads the part of the pastoral letter which explains what they meant by liberation.
It demands conversion of heart and mind, and is not satisfied with merely changing structures. It excludes violence, which it considers unchristian and evangelical, ineffective and unworthy of the humanity of the people.
Romero was very careful always to keep clear of purely political groups. For him, the gospel came first.
Although he knew that a right-wing group had already put out a contract on his life, the Archbishop refused protection. he continued to speak out against the violence which continued to devastate his country. At the beginning of Lent, the church's radio transmitter was destroyed by a bomb. A workman in the basilica found a suitcase with 72 sticks of dynamite. The sands were running out. Romero went to the hills above San Salvador to make a last retreat. He felt his end to be near.
Martyrdom is a grace of God that I do not believe I deserve. But if God accepts the sacrifice of my life, let my blood be a seed of freedom and the sign that hope will soon be reality. Let my death, if it is accepted by God, be for the liberation of my people and as a witness of hope in the future.
On Sunday, the 23rd of March, Romero preached in the cathedral for the last time. The next day, it was announced in the press that the Archbishop was to say the 6 p.m. evening mass in the chapel of the cancer hospital where he lived. As usual, Romero based his homily on the readings. That of the Gospel was on the theme of death and resurrection.
You have just heard the Gospel of Christ, that one must not love oneself to the point of refusing to become involved in the risks of life that history demands of us, and that those who fend off danger will lose their lives. But whoever, out of love for Christ, gives himself to the service of others, will live like the grain of wheat that dies but only seems to die. If it did not die, it would remain alone. Only in undoing itself does it produce the harvest.
On the tomb of Oscar Romero in San Salvador Cathedral are written these words: "You knew death would come without warning, but death is a seed when the people follow after."
In March 1983, Pope John Paul II prayed at the tomb of Oscar Romero, praising him as a model bishop and echoing his plea for peace and respect for human rights in El Salvador. When he left, he appointed Bishop Rivera Damas as Archbishop of El Salvador.
Monsignor Romero represents a martyr of our times, who, being of one mind with the Church, gave his life in defense of the poorest of the poor. He is a new kind of martyr.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that dramatisation of the life and legacy of Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero. That brings us to the end of today's programme. Thank you for joining me, Philippa Hitchin. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.